you certainly weren't the child prodigy.
No.
You started in your teens somewhere, right?
As a matter of fact, I started at the age of 16 to have piano lessons. And what had happened was that my father had a restaurant, and in the restaurant they used to have a band that played on weekends, on Fridays and Saturdays for dancing, three- or four-piece band. And I recall to this day that my father, who had been an immigrant, didn't very much care about people who wrote and asked you for money, like organizations called ASCAP, because he was playing ASCAP music. He didn't know what ASCAP was. Certainly I didn't. I was a child. But the ASCAP people came in one time as they were surveying. This is back, of course, in the early 30s. And the band started to play "You Can't Pull the Wool Over My Eyes," which I thought was rather, you know, ironic. And so they fined my father. He had an injunction. He couldn't use music. So he paid what he thought was a colossal fine of $800, which absolutely outrageous. He had no reason why. I wish he could know how much I get from ASCAP these days. He'd feel the investment was worthwhile. But in any case, what happened was that at the age of 16, they ceased having music at my father's place. And he said, "What do you want for your 16th birthday?" And I said, "I would like that upright piano we have at the restaurant there. You know, it's an old beat-up piano, but you're not using it. And I can only use it on Sundays when we're closed." So he said, "You want that? We wanted to bring it to the house?" I said, "Yeah, could I have it?" He said, "All right." I came home on my 16th birthday from school, eager to see that upright piano in some corner of our home. There was a brand new baby grand piano he had gone out and bought. And I just felt, you know, that with that, I simply had to become a musician. There was no going back. And I started taking piano lessons. So I did take piano lessons. At 16 to 18, was drafted. And when I got out of the Army, I had the GI Bill, so I wanted to go to conservatory. I thought I was going to be a piano major. I signed up as a piano major. And when I got to the conservatory, I discovered that absolutely everybody in the conservatory, including secretaries and janitors, played the piano better than I did, because 2 years is no preparation for a conservatory student. Luckily, just about at the point where I was, you know, considering suicide or accounting or something different, the harmony teacher I had was a gentleman named Nicholas Nabokov, first cousin to Vladimir Nabokov. And he said, "Your harmony exercises are all very interesting. Do you write music?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, would you consider thinking about over the summer, write some pieces. Go home and read the letters of Mozart and write some pieces." And that was the strangest bit of advice I've ever had. I did get the letters of Mozart, and I did read them, and it did change my life. And I did write a few pieces of music. And I came back, and he said, "Let's make you a composition major."
I've talked to some composers who seem to have had these epiphany moments when, say, they're listening to the radio or to a record, where mm-hmm. all of a sudden that music clicks, it speaks to them in a way that nothing else has,
yes.
And from that moment on, they knew they have to have a life in music, or maybe even writing music. And it doesn't sound like there was really that same moment.
Well, there was something similar. At about the age of 14 or so, I was starting to haunt our local public library, mainly because I was building model airplanes. And that in the hobby section was rather close to music, which I stumbled on. And there was a biography of George Gershwin. Well, I knew the name George Gershwin. I'd heard Rhapsody in Blue. I wasn't thrilled that I heard it. And here was a biography, and I thought, well, I'll read it. And in the biography, he talks about Igor Stravinsky. Well, certainly he mentions Rite of Spring. I actually, at the library, you could get records at the time, and I did get the recording. And I thought, that's not bad. And I read his biography, and he talked about Rimsky-Korsakov. And little by little, I wormed my way through music backwards, all the way back to Josquin des Prez or someone. It was never an epiphany, I'm sorry to say. I wish I could say, you know, I was struck by a bolt of lightning. And somebody, Puccini says, you know, God tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Write operas now. Mind, nothing but operas."
Did the family, did your folks pressure you to get some honest work instead of music?
Wasn't pressure. Being immigrants, music was a sort of flighty notion for a career. And like a good Jewish family, they would have preferred me to be a doctor or a lawyer. I don't think they even knew there were other vocations, but those were the two top ones, if there were any. And they did think they'd like me to do it. But somewhere, because of my interest in building model airplanes and all, when I got to high school and I was starting my piano lessons, as a matter of fact, I got a choice. I don't know if they do it any longer in high school, but I had a choice of taking what was called a commercial course, which was learning to be a secretary or a bookkeeper or something, the classical course, which prepared you for college, or the industrial course. And I chose the industrial course. I don't think I even consulted my parents about it. They didn't know much about those things. So I chose the industrial course, which meant that throughout my entire high school experience, 2 weeks were spent in a factory on an apprenticeship to be a machinist or toolmaker, and 2 weeks in school. And I just loved that. I thought, you know, that was neat. I was going to become a great toolmaker, whatever that means. But I was very interested in doing that. And I had no college preparation. But throughout all of that, the parents never said one thing or another. You know, if I wanted to be in an industrial course, fine. If I wanted to have a piano, fine. They would have liked the lawyer or the doctor degree. But if it was not to be, there was no pressure about it. They weren't particularly musical either, so they had no, you know, feeling one way or the other.
Are you a craftsman with your hands?
Yeah.
Do you like
I think there's a real relationship between all of that. Maybe it only applies to me, but at least in my own case, I see it. The idea that the Army decided that I was a cryptographer, I didn't decide that, but they gave you various tests when you were first drafted. And they were giving us this test on Morse code. I had never heard Morse code. But about 250 of us were in this room, and they were playing slowly, dit, 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 and you were supposed to recognize the letters.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was rhythmic. It was always dit, dit, dot, and then little by little, it sped up. And as it got faster and faster, the others around me were dropping like flies. And after a while, I was the only one left in the room, and they're going, dit, 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 pop, pop, pop. Now, I'm hearing it as music. You know, I'm hearing rhythmic patterns, so I recognize it. And they said, this boy is a, you know, budding genius on the Morse code. And before I knew it, I was sent off to a school, an intelligence school, and learning code and cryptography and the whole business. But in my mind, there's an association or a connection between cryptography, which I had a natural knack for, building model airplanes, which I wanted to do, writing music, which I think is another form of solving problems, and the fact that I'm an incorrigible reader of mysteries. You know, I'll read the worst mysteries in the world. I think I do read the worst mysteries in the world because I've read all the best ones. But all of those in my mind are connected with something that you're given some things, and you have to consider them, contemplate them, and come to a conclusion about them, about whether the final object is a plane or a composition or a decoded message.
Is there something that really intrigues you about the problem of it, though, the problem solving?
The process is what pleases me. It's not so much the outcome. For example, to get down to nitty-gritty, if we have a sewer back up in our basement, rather than call Roto-Rooter, which I can't afford to do, I would rather try to find a way to do it myself. I like doing it. It's the process that you're building toward an end, or you're starting something in order to accomplish this goal. And it's not so much what it is at the end. And it's funny, composition isn't exactly like that. Composition for me is quite a different matter. No composition I've ever started turned out to be the composition that was on paper. I mean, I always think I'm starting to write this piece, but when it's finished, it's that piece. It doesn't go where it wants to go. And we can talk about that if you like, but it's just, that's a different one. It's maybe it is connected. Maybe what I'm still just enjoying is the procedure, not the actual result.
What is the course of a composition for you? Do you, when you set out to write a piece, what are you trying to do with that piece? What is the end goal? Are you trying to communicate an emotion to somebody, an idea, or something else?
I think there are two kinds of composers, and I think we are pre-wired. There are those who are simply pre-wired to be experimenters, pioneers, martyrs, if you like. Then there are other composers who simply are not. And I think their purpose is simply to write music that does communicate. The thing that comforts me most of all is that side by side are these two wonderful composers, one named Richard Wagner, who's out there mudding up the whole playing field. And then here's Giuseppe Verdi, who's simply grinding out one more beautiful opera after another. To me, they have equal value. But there's something in Wagner's psyche that just said, find a new way of writing drama and opera, music. And there's something over here, Verdi, who's saying, I wonder if I can do this better than Rossini did it. But those are the two types. My type, I know. Just I'm not born to experiment musically. I may in other forms, you know, in the way I do plumbing and so on. But the idea of writing a piece for me, the primary idea, is to make some spark cross from me to you. And it's the music I write that I think carries the spark. I think every artist's primary goal is to give the spark of ignition. And it depends on the listener out there, what kind of fuel is in them, whether they're going to catch fire or not. Somebody who says it's far better than I could ever say is Joseph Conrad in the preface, the only preface I think he ever wrote about art is the preface to The Nigger of the Narcissus. And he talks about this lonely business of the artist who reaches within himself, pulls out whatever it is, this piece of his temperament, and passes it on to someone. And if he's lucky, there'll be someone out there who has a similar temperament who will understand and respond to or get the feeling from it that he wants them to have the feeling of. This is probably the time to talk about how I go about writing a piece.
Yeah, I'd like to know what you do with that.
You can start anywhere. And usually I start by rummaging in my drawers for an old piece that I never finished. I don't throw anything away, no matter how bad it is, because it might fit somewhere else. And I always start that. It never works. I mean, I always go through these hundreds of scraps, and there's got to be something here, nothing. And so we start with something else. And I can guide a piece. I can write and add to it day by day until the piece is about 1/4 of its length. And at that point, the piece begins to write itself. And I don't mean that in any mysterious way. I mean that I don't have much choice about it. After this, I just know it's got to be that. And the reason I know it's got to be that is because the piece is now telling me that's what I want here. It really starts to take over. And that's why I said earlier that no piece I've ever written turned out to be the piece that I started to write. Because when I start, I never foresee what's down there at the end. That sort of just happens when the piece is, say, 1/4, 1/3, even less done. And then it starts to say, well, why don't we do this, Dominic? Hey, how about let's do? And it's the reason why I drive my wife crazy, but I can never add one bar to a piece of music without going back and playing it from the beginning again. I mean, I can't play the 4 bars up to this point, then add one more bar, then add one up. I've got to go back all the way to the beginning, find out if it fits and it makes sense where it is. And so the piece says, okay, let's go. That's all right. We'll accept that.
With Peter Quince at the clavier, what kinds of things were you trying to achieve with the choir and the text setting, let's say? How did you illustrate the text or think about illustrating that text so it would come across in a way that was more than just reading?
Well, the worst thing I think you can do in setting text is to simply ape the original meter. Yeah. One of the reasons I've almost exclusively set prose in my whole career. I've set very few real poems to music and almost no contemporary poems except the Wallace Stevens one. I prefer prose. I've set letters, diaries, journals, pamphlets. You know, I could set the back of a detergent box, the instructions on how to do silk or whatever. I like that because I get the opportunity then to make the rhythm of it. I get the opportunity to decide which are the words that ought to be stressed rather than the poet. It's too difficult to take a real poem that has to be or not to be. That, you know, we already got the iambic pentameter going, you know, you can't sort of just sit on the to part, you got to get to the be. Whereas with prose, I feel completely at liberty to do whatever I think is there. And everything has a subtext for me. When I'm setting it to music, it's not just the text that's being sung, but there's underneath that another text, I think, much like it. But there's another text that suggests certain emphases that you wouldn't do in the original one, or certain ways of stressing, prolonging words. As you may have noticed from even that piece, I will never repeat words the way, you know, often is done in songs or particularly in older music. Bach could make a 5-minute piece out of I Will Be a Shield Upon Thine Arm.
Mm-hmm.
That would drive me nuts, obviously, for, you know, Bach is another aesthetic. But apart from that, I think I pay more attention to words than probably some composers do. I'm very fond of words. I'm very fond of language.
And you're also setting English text, and yeah. English probably doesn't fall that way as much as, say, Italian.
More so, yeah. I mean, English is probably the most difficult language, I think.
It's got to be.
Rhythmically. Because, well, a wonderful thing about Italian, you can take a verb like I am, io sono, and you can say io sono on four vowels, or io sono on three, or io, or io son on two, or just son on one. Mm. And it, apparently it doesn't make any difference. It certainly didn't make any difference to Verdi or Puccini. You can't get away with that kind of thing in English. And I think, you know, the French are so tied up to their language, they're so respectful of it, they wouldn't dream of the kind of approaches that Americans take to American English.
You got the Pulitzer Prize for the song cycle from the Diary of Virginia Woolf. 1975, mm-hmm. I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
That work may be your most widely recorded.
Oddly enough, it's not.
Not really?
No, I had to make up a discography, and I discovered there are four recordings of Virginia Woolf, but there are six of six Elizabethan songs.
Oh, really?
And six Elizabethan songs are simply, well, they're more recordable. They're easier to sing, mm-hmm. and they happen to be on the required repertoire list in all Canadian schools of music, which is a big deal to me. I think I find that more interesting than the Pulitzer Prize, that you can't get out of a Canadian school of music as a voice major unless you learn the six Elizabethan songs.
You also, as I understand it, you were writing the one text, or you were working on one text, and then when you were trying to research that novel, you went to the diaries,
yeah.
and then you ended up studying the diary instead.
Yeah. A wonderful friend of mine, Robert Moore, who taught English at the university, at one time called my attention to the interludes in a novel called The Waves. And the interludes, which happen about every 30 pages or so, are a paragraph or two on the rising of the sun out at sea. So at the very beginning, it only comes up, you know, slightly. And then you have to read part of the novel. Then the next section continues that progression until the full sun is out, high sun. And I thought, well, that was an interesting idea. You could write four or five songs, each one a progression. And then I started thinking about, well, maybe that ain't so hot. And I knew her writer's diary had just come out. And I thought, I'd like to look up in her diary what she was thinking about, what she intended by this, when she was writing these episodes. And the moment I got hold of the writer's diary and started reading it, I mean, forget the wave. I mean, this is where it is. Because, first of all, it's so private. It's so non-public. I mean, she wasn't writing that diary for publication. And it's so sparse, and it's so pure. There's not a bit of slab on it. It's, you know, complete honesty in those remarks. That just sold me on the text.
I've heard that you have quit writing operas now.
Oh, I haven't quit. I'm just tired. I've written 13 operas, if you count one before that, even 14. But the point is that, and there's a kind of, I've been lucky. I don't think I've ever written an opera that didn't have a second performance, and a good many of them had third and fourth, and, you know, some even have gone on for a while. But none of them really has, you know, made a way into anybody's real repertoire. As I was going to say, you know, if it gets done, it's the oddity on the season.
Mm-hmm.
And since they're all so fresh and unknown, they're all practically virgins, I don't know why I should add to the population of, you know, if people want to do an Argento opera, there's a lot there to pick from that have either not been done in this town or not been done in that town. And that, you know, I feel a little peculiar adding more to that. I have a vision of the repertoire. I think other composers may share it. Here is something called the repertoire. It's a big mountain. And we composers make our little spitballs, and we throw it up, and for a moment it looks like it's going to cling, and it stays there for about, you know, 2 seconds, and then it starts rolling down, and before you know it's off again. And every opera company in this country has a 23 or 4 masterpiece list. And they will choose their 5 or 6 operas off of that. And they'll go for 5 years, and they won't repeat it. Then it's time to go back to Pagliacci and talk about it. And they're very happy with that. They really don't particularly need a new opera. I don't know what it is that it would be. I wish I had the energy to contemplate it. What does it take to make an opera company realize that they not only have become a museum, but they've now become a kind of dusty, boring museum at that?
Well, now that you have entered your 8th decade...
Is it that already? don't say things like that.
Sorry.
And heart, I'm 16 years old.
Well,
I'm just waiting to go for my next piano lesson and hope I don't get, trapped on knuckles.
I was going to make a nice comparison to Verdi and how he wrote some of his best stuff when he was in his 70s.
Yes, he did.
Is this going to be the glory decade for you?
I don't know. The fact that you bring up... There he was in retirement, and he had vowed he was not writing any more operas. And when he did get around to writing Falstaff or Otello, what he did was do it for himself and do it secretly, and it was not commissioned, and it was not nobody who got to pester him to sing the lead in it or have the first premiere and so forth.
Having been a teacher for 40 years, does that change your point of view as a composer?
No, the good thing, I guess, about having done it is that talking to the student critically, in other words, looking at their music and making observations about, you know, you've used that high note 16 times in this first page, don't you think that's a bit much? All of those kinds of criticisms, you become much more conscious about them in your own work. So when you go back and you're doing, you say, oh my God, I've been doing that too. I'm worse than that. But it just sort of keeps you fresh about what it is you're doing. And with a variety of students, there are so many possible things to criticize that would improve it, that you get back and you start to think about, I could do that in my own piece. I could fix that. I could make that more interesting, again, by drawing a section out and cutting this one off, that the sort of thing I was just telling a student earlier. So those are. The other thing, the wonderful thing about teaching was just the enthusiasm you see around the young composers. I mean, I think, I don't know, I can't say that I've kept enthusiasm or not kept it, but I've felt enthusiastic about music all through it because I've been around kids. They are kids to me, 19, 20, 21, 22, and some graduate students in the late 20s. But the love for writing music that they feel is contagious. And I'm an old warrior at it, so I should have lost, but I haven't. When I go to New York, for example, and I sit on a jury with some colleagues, composers are even more famous than I am, we don't talk about that kind of thing, that kind of enthusiasm. We talk about the politics which have kept so-and-so from being famous, the other one that aced him out of a Pulitzer Prize. You know, we're up in the world where all of the bad things are happening. And if you stayed in that world very long, I think you'd lose your enthusiasm. And it's such a relief to leave New York after that kind of 3 or 4 days and come back and meet a student who comes in, just full of beans and wants to, what I've been thinking of, Dr. Argento, I'm going to know. And yeah, that's the answer. Well, I'm so glad you got the solution. It's fun. That's just wonderful.